State lawmakers wrap up the 2018 session's first half. A Colts linebacker's death enters the immigration debate. That plus a federal budget deal and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending February 9, 2018.
Ice Miller is proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, the General Assembly concluded the first half of its 2018 session, and the biggest headlines may have been about what didn't pass rather than what did.
Lawmakers in both chambers checked the boxes of some of the biggest priorities for the session, including workforce development measures and bills to address the state's opioid addiction epidemic. But on the deadline days, many looked to what didn't survive: legislation to expand cold beer sales, a hate crimes bill, and township government reform. Township reform was a priority of both House GOP leadership and the Indiana Chamber of Commerce, yet it didn't emerge from the Republican caucus room for a vote on the floor. That bill would have forced more than 300 small townships across the state to consolidate in the next 5 years.
Is the 2018 session becoming more about what didn't pass than what did? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Elise Schrock, Republican Mike O'Brien, Leslie Weidenbender, managing editor of the Indianapolis Business Journal, and political analyst John Katzenberger. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting Statehouse reporter Brandon Smith. Elise Schrock, were you surprised to see, for instance, township reform go down in flames?
Sure. I think there was some surprise at how it went down this year, but township government reform has been thwarted for over a decade now. Whether it's 1005 this year or the Kernan Shepherd report in 2009, it seems to be something we just can't get past the halfway point. It was a Indiana Chamber of Commerce priority. It was one of many that didn't actually see any type of legs this year. So I guess we can ask if the Indiana GOP is losing touch with them. I don't think it's too shocking, but it was shocking that it was a priority and it's not moving.
Yeah, she mentions the Indiana Chamber of Commerce had a few things that didn't get past the halfway point, including a bill to raise the minimum smoking age, a bill, the hate crimes bill, which we've talked about obviously on here before, this township government reform. Is the Chamber of Commerce losing just a tiny little bit of clout at the State House?
Well, those are three tough issues. So, you know, the chamber tried to pick those off, and it didn't happen. I think the township reform bill specifically, one, Representative Cindy Zemke worked really hard on that to try to build a coalition. I think they let it hang around too long. Sometimes if you let it started off with a lot of support, the township association was okay with it. It was just kind of a common sense measure. You eliminate townships under 1,200 people, right? Make them consolidate with other townships. You're still under a township government. It's just, you know, you just be able to leverage those efficiencies. And it just caught, it just kind of started catching a lot of weight as the weeks went on. You know, if they would have voted that in the first or second week, I think it'd be in the Senate. I think that thing's probably rolling, and people in those small townships are just kind of viewing that as inevitable. As far as the other things that haven't passed, I think there's still a lot out there that will pass. And, you know, as far as my friends are concerned, if Sunday sales passes, this will be the greatest legislative session in the history of the General Assembly or the state of Indiana. So that's still out there. Now, there's a couple issues that just aren't getting a lot of attention. I mean, there's a lot of legislation right still moving on workforce issues, sure, the governor and Republican agenda on that, on the opiate addiction, and moving some money out of this out of reserves to cover the increase in enrollment in K-12 schools, which we had to do this year, and Republicans are going to deliver on.
Yeah, so he brings up something interesting, which is there are workforce development bills moving in both
chambers.
Yeah,
but they're not. It's not what the Republicans wanted. It's not what the what the House Republicans wanted. House Republicans were willing to go further and do more, and they're actually pulling back in that area too. And I think the chamber wanted them to do more. In fact, for several years now, Brian Bosma has been talking about how there's, you know, $10 billion being spent by all these various agencies, and the legislature has to do something about it, and then they keep just nibbling around the edges. So that's an area where I actually am very surprised that some of these other things, I agree, they're very tough issues, and just because they're not the kind of issues, like, for instance, the townships, that's not the kind of issue that the chamber is going to be terribly influential
sticking all
on.
Its capital on?
Yeah, it's not the kind of issue they're going to be that influential on, because they're talking about local officials.
And the Farm Bureau opposed it.
But the workforce stuff, that is surprising. It's surprising to me that that's taking so long for the Republicans to figure out what to do with. And it probably just goes to show you how complicated it is.
It is complicated, but it is the top priority, not just of the Republican caucuses, not just of the governor. The Democrats say it's one of their top priorities. It's the top priority for everybody at the State House. And yet, you didn't hear about those bills until basically the deadline days, when they passed easily, I might add, but they passed.
Well, I think building on Leslie's point, economic development strategies are changing, and the way that economic development is done around the country is changing. It's always evolving. And I think what you've seen is some reticence to make big changes because we haven't quite figured out how those changes are working and how best to address those changes. So this is not a defense, but it might be an explanation. You go a little bit slow until you have a better idea. You know, we see with Amazon this competition against cities. That's a wrinkle on traditional economic development. And I think we're starting to enter an era where governments won't be able to afford the kinds of incentives that they were able to give in the past. And I think that's true in many areas of around the country. So I think that the nature of economic development is changing, and the legislature probably ought to take a little bit of time to try to figure it out. The system is very big now. It's grown over the last 30-plus years. You need to bring it down. You need to modify it and streamline it, but you don't want to do it just for the sake of doing it right now when you have all this change occurring.
Well, the legislature, the state, has spent millions of dollars trying to find some magic formula that will determine, that will tell people, here's what the hot jobs are, here's what you should get a degree in, if you live in Kokomo, you should do this. And the truth is, it's not that simple. And I think what they're finding is they want to be able to just rely on data. They want to have a formula. They want to have some easy way to try to get people into the right thing. But the economy is changing so fast that some of the very jobs that are listed as hot jobs right now could be obsolete.
Yeah, we can't train you for a job that you're going to have for 30 years. So it's a really hard message. It's like, hey, you're going to graduate from college, you're going to have 10 different jobs. We have no idea what the last nine are.
That's right.
Right. High wage, high demand today, maybe something completely different tomorrow.
Right, that's right.
And the problem with going slow, though, is you feel like you're always playing catch up.
Well, I think that that's true. But the danger of going too fast is overcalculating or missing the point.
Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Eismiller email and text alerts. This week's question, what grade would you give this year's General Assembly at the halfway point? Your choices are A, B, C, D, or F. Last week's question, does the failure of hate crimes legislation make it harder for Indiana to attract Amazon? 75% say yes, 25% say no. If you would like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Colts linebacker Edwin Jackson and Uber driver Jeffrey Monroe were killed this week in a drunk driving crash, allegedly by an immigrant in this country illegally.
Prosecutors filed charges this week against Manuel Orrego Zavala, an immigrant in this country illegally from Guatemala, who's twice been deported. Orrego Zavala is alleged to have hit Colts player Edwin Jackson and his Uber driver Jeffrey Monroe while the two men were standing outside Monroe's car on I-70 early Sunday. President Trump tweeted about the incident, calling it disgraceful, and he used it to prod Democrats to work on immigration reform. Local prosecutor Terry Curry called those comments inappropriate and ghoulish.
Mike O'Brien, is the president politicizing the strategy?
I think he's pointing at this as an example of here's why we need to solve this broader problem. I think the problem with that, though, is very similar to, especially in this kind of situation, where you have a guy who was deported twice, is back in the country illegally, is a criminal. I mean, was committing a crime again. It's not unlike when we have one of these mass shootings and everybody kind of rushes to gun control. We're not trying to solve that problem. If you go in like the national, like the policy context of the problem we're trying to solve on gun control, which is maybe enhanced background checks and some other things that we can do that kind of make everybody safer, but really don't do anything for the mass murderer who's going to go and find a way to go kill people. I mean, it's similar to this. I think it pollutes the immigration debate in the sense that we're trying to do something. There's a broad bipartisan coalition, I think, that can find a place to land on DACA. And then there's the kind of the other bucket of immigration issues. Is there a path to citizenship for the people that are currently here who are illegal? Are we building a wall? You know, all these different things kind of in that. And they're all leveraged off of one another. I don't think you can take this guy and go, see, we got to solve that problem, because you're not going to solve that problem. You're not going to solve the problem of the guy from Guatemala who came here 3 times illegally, was deported twice, and then killed 2 people. You know, I mean, that's not the problem we're really trying to solve. We're trying to thread a more common needle here on immigration policy that accommodates dreamers in some way, and we're going to figure that out hopefully here in the next 6 weeks. And then pick from the list of other outstanding kind of immigration issues. But I think, you know, pointing at this example, and one, rushing to it and not acknowledging that this was a terrible tragedy for these 2 people and their families, is probably the first thing we should have done.
How much more difficult does this make? I mean, we are having this conversation hopefully in the next couple of months. How much more difficult is that conversation now because of something like this?
You know, I think people can set a clear line between what really happened here. That's a crime that happens every day in our city, our state. That's drunk driving. That's what happened in this instance. It's tragic. But to your point, to generalize an entire population based on a criminal act by one person is wholly unfair. And in fact, there are many undocumented immigrants that experience crime as on the victim's side. They're preyed upon because there's no clear way for them to report. I mean, we go back and we work on U visas for victims of domestic violence so that we can try and catch perpetrators of that terrible act, and we've worked really hard to try and work with people in that community so they know they have protections. They don't. And that speaks to your point on we need to make some clear reforms on immigration and make reporting a lot easier.
Mike drew a parallel to mass shootings and the reactions to that. For better or for worse, those things are often forgotten pretty quickly nowadays. Is this another thing that's going to go by the wayside fairly quickly?
I think this particular incident probably, unfortunately. But I think, you know, what we've heard from Elise and Mike are rational thoughts and arguments. And what we saw from the president, without any real surprise, was an irrational response. And too often, those irrational responses, whether it's the president, whether it's members of Congress, whether it's just people on Twitter, you know, spewing out their filth, we expect people to act in rational ways. Congress won't act rationally until we start to think in terms of rational thought. This is a terrible tragedy. It's a situation that should not have occurred. But to deal with it is to figure out the immigration problem, whatever it might be, and to enforce that situation so that people who are illegal are not here. The broader question of drunk driving. Deal with that issue and try to find out ways to reduce the number of drunk drivers on the road so that they don't cause the harm and mayhem that they cause now. We have to begin to think rationally.
Is this the sort of incident that those who don't particularly care to move the immigration debate forward will use to derail it?
Oh, of course. Yes, absolutely. But it's also, I agree with Mike, though, it is very similar in many ways to the gun debate. I mean, it is, the president's reaction is incredibly unfortunate, and nobody should immediately jump to politicizing these kinds of events. But that happens on both sides.
Absolutely.
And I think the gun debate is a perfect example. And so people who are outraged that President Trump and other Republicans would use this in a way to try to advance their side should think about that the next time that there is a different kind of event. I think both sides, to John's point, need to think about these things in a more rational way and to think about what are the changes we can make that would actually make a difference.
Well, federal Republican and Democratic leaders reached agreements this week on a budget deal that will keep the government funded for another several weeks.
The budget deal would include language to raise the federal debt limit through March of 2019 and raise spending limits on domestic and military funding. The measure also includes disaster aid dollars. Hardline conservatives don't like the deal because of its significant spending increases. Those on the far left of the spectrum are unhappy over a lack of protections for recipients of the federal immigration program, DACA. Republican leaders Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell say they're committed to bringing immigration reform, including DACA, to the floor.
Leslie Weidmatter, should we believe Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell when they say they're going to bring DACA to the floor?
Well, I think this is one of those things that reminds me sort of like a peace process, you know, where you have meetings about having the, you know, a peace process. So
that's the only function of Congress.
Yeah, well, I mean,
it's very intentional.
Yeah, I believe they are promising to have meetings about it, to maybe have meetings about it. So no, I don't think it necessarily means something's coming to the floor.
We just had a conversation in the last topic, obviously, about immigration reform. What are the, in your mind, what are the chances we actually see any sort of meaningful immigration reform as it relates to the DACA program in the next couple of months?
You know, you make a prediction in this atmosphere, and I've been wrong so many times, because nothing that you could use as a guidepost holds anymore.
Yeah. You'll be back in a week, though.
We're not keeping score.
Let me write this down.
This is on television.
I do happen to think that they will get something done, because there is such broad support among Americans for the DACA program. I think it's that the Republican leadership understands that it's in its best interest to do something about that. And if they don't, then they stand to run the risk of political harm in the fall. So I think there is a real chance that we'll see something in the next few months.
Do you think Democratic voters are a little frustrated that their members of Congress are just kind of mostly willing to believe Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell when they say that they're going to work on this?
Well, again, I mean, I don't think they're shocked to see incremental steps towards something like this. But I do, to your point, think that there is broadening public support for DACA students. And we've talked about workforce earlier on the show. Let's talk about workforce again. I think the reason there's such broad support is people see that this is less than an us and them issue. It's not. It's our issue. These DACA students are going to school with our kids. They go to our churches. They go, you know, and work in our businesses. Whether you're at Cummins or a corner restaurant, you're depending on them to staff your business, likely. So I think that we're all ready to let them be a part of the business and economic development that they've already helped us create.
Do you think enough people in Congress think the way that Elise is talking about?
Well, the premise of this entire conversation so far has been on the fact that they've passed this, but they've passed a budget, and now they've funded the government again for another four weeks. The problem with this debate in Washington is it's never about let's pass a budget and let's fund the government, because the far left and the far right go, well, we can only do that if we talk about immigration or abortion, or we got to leverage it as much as we can to get whatever the fringe issue is of the day wrapped into it, instead of just having an up or down discussion and policy debate on the budget or on funding the government and at what level should we do that and for how long should we do that. It always gets tied up in these other issues. So, you know, Politico had a headline this afternoon that was like your comic book guy's best quote, dumbest shutdown ever. And so the thought on Capitol Hill is, why did we do that? Why did we let one guy, in this case Rand Paul, and whatever you think of Rand Paul or his policies, I agree with him way more than I disagree with him, but one guy can't just like hold the entire federal budget hostage. What, because he's upset
that spending went
up a little bit, right?
I think that just
we've got to have a little bit more honest, just isolated debates on these issues. Instead, it just gets leveraged all over everything. Everything else gets leveraged off of the big question of funding the government and whether or not it's going to be shut down. We've had two of these shutdowns in the last 5 weeks, and nobody's won anything.
And of course, in the background of all of this, all the time, there are elections this year.
That's right.
Speaking of which, 6th District Republican congressional candidate Jonathan Lamb sought to make a big play Sunday, running an ad during the Super Bowl.
Lamb, a Yorktown businessman, is running for the seat currently held by Luke Messer. He's running against Greg Pence, the older brother of Vice President Mike Pence, which Lamb made the subject of his ad. In it, he jokingly says there have been lambs working at the White House for a century, noting President Woodrow Wilson used actual lambs, the animals, to help keep up the White House lawn.
The Lamb family has a proven track record of getting things done in D.C. I'm Jonathan Lamb, and I approve this message.
John Katzenberger, is this a bad ad?
Oh, my gosh. You know, I'd like to say it's a bad ad, but I can't. Yeah. For one, it's clever. Two, it's memorable. Three, he put it on at a time when a lot of people were likely to see it. So,
and
he,
four, we're talking about
it
right
now.
That's exactly
show.
Right, and we're making the bad puns about it. So I think it goes in kind of that Hall of Fame where, You know, you take a concept, because some of the other ads that he's done, he's been running on the running ad and all of that kind of thing. He's at least playing to a theme and is consistent about that. So props.
Do you think this, I mean, this ad isn't going to win or lose anybody an election,
sure,
but is this the sort of thing that can help vault a guy into contention against who is obviously a front runner in Greg Pence?
I think it's too much to say it can vault him into contention, but it certainly can catch people's eye. It can catch the media's eye. It does have us talking here right now. And so every conversation that takes place about it is a conversation about this candidate who that wouldn't have taken place before. And it very much helps you remember who he is.
That's right.
And there's so much about a lot of these races that really is about name ID. So,
in that race, he's got a lot of ground to make up
on
name ID.
Yeah.
I'll put it this way, quite frankly. Is there any chance Greg Pence is worried at all about this race, or do you think he's got it mostly locked up?
I don't think he's acting like he's got it mostly locked up. I mean, he's running a campaign. But I think Jonathan Lamb outraised Greg Pence by, and he put a lot of his own money.
He put a lot of his own money.
But that didn't really matter. It's
spent. It doesn't matter once you've got
money,
it in the bank.
It's money. The TV station doesn't ask where the money came from.
Right.
They just make sure the wire hits, and then they throw your ad on TV.
Anytime a Republican wants to throw a couple tens of grams of dollars at an ad at a one-shot chance, I'm okay with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
You know. Fine.
All right, well, another
the 6th district. I mean, let's put this in context of where this is. This election's the primary, so
yes,
they're going to spend it to zero.
Another fraternity at Indiana University was suspended this week for inappropriate conduct.
The International Tau Kappa Epsilon Fraternity Council this week closed its Indiana University chapter until 2021, citing a violation of chapter bylaws. That's after IU's Interfraternity Council voted in November to suspend all social events involving alcohol and new member activities for all fraternities and sororities until the end of this month. Tau Kappa Epsilon's suspension marks the 6th action taken against IU Greek communities in just 2 years. Others have been temporarily or permanently suspended, most often due to hazing incidents.
Mike O'Brien, is it time to have a serious conversation about the very existence of fraternities and sororities?
I think it's at least time to have a very serious conversation about what's happening in these buildings, you know, which, unless you're in a music fraternity, I mean, it seems like a lot's going on that shouldn't be going on. And does it require some adult supervision that's kind of like there all the time? I mean, when I was in my dorm, we couldn't just do whatever we wanted because I wasn't in a fraternity, but, you know, in our dorm, we had grad students who were required to live there to kind of monitor what we were doing, and, you know, they had this kind of system of checks and people checking in and monitoring activity, and I don't know why that's different if you're in a different house on, you know, housing situation on campus. I don't think it's, you know, it's not for me to say we should just get rid of this whole system. I think it's particularly in smaller colleges, smaller universities, you know, Greek life can be kind of the critical thing that kind of binds all these people, right? But, you know, that doesn't mean you can go force somebody to drink an entire bottle of vodka and expect to get away with it for very long.
Yeah, how rapidly do things need to change in these communities?
Well, I don't think we can just act like kicking one fraternity off of a campus is going to change the campus culture. I think we need to bring it, bring that viewpoint up much larger. It's happening in sports with coaches. It's happening in other organizations. And, you know, I think universities, even the traditional ones, are moving towards more co-ed and multi-community experiences because people have to learn to coexist. And they do that by being together every single day. I mean, there are a lot of issues that play into this. Social media, alcohol, the mind-boggling to me fact that somehow kids are entering campuses at 18 years old and still don't have a grasp of the concept of consent. I think that's shocking. And those are all things we need to be talking about. I don't know that kicking one fraternity off a campus or temporarily suspending them is going to fix all
that. That's more about liability than it is about changing behavior.
Yeah,
that's right.
There's a lot of measures at the State House the last few years, and again this year to address bullying. That's in K-12 schools. Do lawmakers need to paying it? Oh, that's not the way you phrase
it. The answer is yes.
Yeah. Do we need to start addressing hazing?
I think so. You know, there have been efforts to eliminate hazing or to reduce the incidence of hazing in the past. In fact, one of the experts on hazing is from Indiana, and so I don't think anybody disagrees that hazing is a bad idea. But the legislature funds the state universities, certainly, and I think has a responsibility to understand what's going on and what they're helping to fund. And I think Elise and Mike both make great points that it's not proper to haze people. It's not proper to force them to do things against their will. And the sooner we get that out of fraternities and everywhere else, the better off we'll be.
Is that a conversation that needs to happen sooner rather than later?
Oh, it has to happen now. It should already be happening. And it is about, it shows up in fraternities because fraternities are generally university-owned. And so, but the larger issue of alcohol and all these consent issues, that's a much bigger question.
And to be fair to fraternities and sororities, I think it's a question that you point that goes beyond the Greek community.
Absolutely.
And to the larger wide
university
culture.
But there is a problem with I think, what Mike said about the fact that they have buildings, they have houses.
Yeah.
They create a place
for
things to take.
Yeah,
for things to happen.
Yeah. Well, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Elise Schrock, Republican Mike O'Brien, Leslie Weidenbender of the Indianapolis Business Journal, and political analyst John Ketzenberger. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Ice Miller is proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.